Welcome. Today I have the great honor of doing an interview with Kathy Orlando. She's the National Manager for Citizens Climate Lobby Canada. She's worked towards climate change by getting letters and opinion pieces published in newspapers in every province. Citizens Climate Lobby, simply known as CCL, is a volunteer-based, nonpartisan grassroots organization with the aim of creating political will for a sustainable world and to empower people to use their political and personal power to fulfill their potential. CCL also has a focus on carbon taxing and economic solutions to the environmental problems that we're facing currently. Can you just start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself and how you became involved with Citizens Climate Lobby, Kathy?
I live in Sudbury, Ontario, and I grew up in southern Ontario. I grew up specifically in Niagara Falls. And in the mid-1970s, Lois Gibbs led the fight at Love Canal across the border from where I lived. And I watched that on the news every night with my mom when I was about 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And I learned from Lois Gibbs and her fight at Love Canal that politicians and corporations don't protect people. People protect people. So in the 1980s, when I decided to go to university, and under the influence of David Suzuki, I was one of his early people that he influenced, I decided to study science in university, even though I was not the keenest science student, but I felt somebody coming of age in the 21st century should know science. So anyways, I went along with my life, and I knew the climate crisis was a serious issue, and I was working on it on the sidelines, but total wake-up call in 2007 when I was 40 years old and pregnant with my third child and heard the grave conclusions of the fourth report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, that if we keep doing what we're doing, the planet will be a very difficult place to live on 40 years from now. So I made a promise to my baby I would do whatever I could. So I got trained by Al Gore, gave 100 presentations within the first 2 years of being trained, felt all along that the politicians needed our help. And in 2010, I bumped into the founder of Citizens Climate Lobby at a climate training meeting, and he liked my attitude and recruited me to CCL thinking I was American. And CCL Canada was born.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because I know that there's a lot of other nations that are also part of CCL. So that's really great that you were able to start that within Canada. Can you tell me what it was like to work with Al Gore?
It was a total honor to be selected from Sudbury to go be trained by Al Gore in 2008. I don't know how familiar your audience may be about Sudbury, but this was pretty much ground zero in Canada for the acid rain treaty in the 1980s. This city is filled with environmental heroes. And I was completely blown away that I was selected from Sudbury to go be trained by him in Montreal. Working with him, he is an incredible human being. He really cares about this issue. He is an expert on many levels of it. His team is fantastic. And I'll just share my one and only time meeting with Al Gore, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
I've been for subsequent training with him, not just in 2008, but 2009, 2010. And in 2009, he stayed to the very end of the conference and at our second training, and only about 30 of us were still left at the very end. So he decided to give each of us one-on-one time.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
I know. So I was second and last in line, and I'm thinking, oh, what can I say? What can I say? And I looked at him when he came to me, and I said, I made a promise to my unborn baby girl that I was going to do whatever I could to protect the climate. Thank you for helping me keep that promise to my baby. And he just looked at me and said, can I have a hug? So I got a hug from Mr. Gore. It was really cool.
Yeah, so it's definitely a very positive interaction. I feel like you've had a lot of really great influences in your life to really put you down this path with, like, David Suzuki, you said. Yeah, so I just want to just touch on our organization at the NATO Association of Canada. So what we do here is we basically focus on engaging and informing Canadians about NATO's goals of peace, prosperity, and security. And so I was just wondering if you thought there was any threat to Canadian sovereignty if climate solutions aren't addressed. And if so, what, like, the most pressing issues that need to be brought up to Parliament, and what's been done so far?
In 2007, when I heard the conclusions of the IPCC report and I got really scared, my first thought was global peace and war. Yeah, so climate change is a threat to global security. Everything's connected. We have to, you know, climate change in mind at all times on all issues, including global security. In 2008, the British Royal United Service Institute warned that a failure to acknowledge climate change security threats is as dangerous as neglecting the risks of terrorism or nuclear nuclear weapons proliferation. In 2011, the United States put forth a new strategic narrative for the 21st century, building upon the strategic narrative that was made in 1948. And they made detailed threats to, like climate change is a threat to the economic and political stability of the United States of America, and by extension, every country. In the 2014 fifth report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, again, there's a whole chapter dedicated to global security and possibilities of violent conflict. And yes, in March of 2016, the Scientific American published an article that outlined how climate change, although it was not a main causal factor in Syria's civil war, certainly hastened it. And the United States Pentagon is now making long-term plans for as part of their global security goals. So, you know, everything is connected. We don't live in closed systems. We live in open systems. Yeah. So we need to address the climate crisis on a global level in order to protect us nationally.
Yeah, and the environment definitely does not see any borders, right? So that definitely is a global issue and a global threat. Can you elaborate more on carbon taxing? Because I know that's what CCL is pushing for. So can you talk a little bit more about carbon taxing and the difference maybe between cap and trade as well?
We like to look at it as five different ways to price carbon. There's the status quo, and that's doing nothing, but really you're paying through your insurance premiums and your taxes for all the climate-related damages. Then there's regulation, and there will be need for regulations, so things like fuel standards and all sorts of things that need to be done to regulate houses and home building and cars will certainly be necessary. But then there's the true carbon pricing, which is cap and trade, carbon tax, and then what, carbon fee and dividend, which are overt carbon pricing. So cap and trade is a model where carbon pricing that's in play in many parts of the world, including the European Union, California, Ontario, Quebec, and national and subnational governments put a cap on carbon emissions, and then they allow for those partaking in that system to trade amongst themselves emissions and offsets in order to stay below that amount of CO2 being emitted into the atmosphere. It's pretty complex, and a couple things to say that I'm for it wholeheartedly. I'm not against it. Subnational governments can't put border tax adjustments on commodities coming across their border, so provinces can't do that, but they can under a cap and trade deal, because they're making deals between each other at subnational government. There's allowing for trade to have some carbon constrictions to it that subnational governments can't do on the world level. So that's a good reason to have cap and trade. So then there's outright carbon taxes, where you just put a price on carbon pollution and take that money and do, and the government does with it what it may. But a couple things to bear in mind about increasing prices on anyone in Canada is approximately 50% of all Canadians are living on the financial cliff within $300 a month or less between not being able to make their bills, and about 10% of Canadians are financially insolvent, like they can't do it. So any sort of carbon pricing model should bear in mind that Canadians are already stretched to the limit from our finances. So if a government imposes a carbon tax, they better take care of the poor and middle class. The last carbon pricing model is a carbon fee and dividend. And that's what we propose at Citizens Climate Lobby, that the government imposes an incrementally increasing price on carbon pollution and 100% of the dividends be returned to households in the form of a check. And it is revenue neutral. And by keeping it revenue neutral, we can ramp that price up to the level that it needs to be by 2030 and not put undue burden on households. As well, you can't have a price of $200 a ton per carbon and take that money and do with it what you will and suck that much money out of the economy and not expect the economy to falter. So
It has to come around back around, right?
Yeah, the money has to circulate back around. I mean, the government should only plan to take so much from the citizens. Mm-hmm. I mean, the citizens need money in order to operate in the society we live in. So that is the three main ways to price carbon. So cap and trade, it's got some good things about it, but it should be revenue neutral. But most preferred is carbon fee and dividend, so we can get that price up as high as we can. Mm-hmm. As well, that monthly dividend check or quarterly dividend check from the government, we're already used to that in Canada with the HST GST rebate. We could maybe combine the two together. That's what Michael Chong is saying we should do. Mm-hmm. Michael Chong is running for leadership of the Conservative Party of Canada. So giving people checks so they know that the government's not taking their carbon taxes and spending it wherever, they're actually mm-hmm. getting it back.
Yeah, I know that we, I think last month, there was a new floor price on carbon released by Trudeau's government for new energy policies to reduce the greenhouse gases. And it was by 2018 that it's going to be $10 a ton, and then they want to increase it by $10 every year. And then by 2022, it's going to be at $50 a year. And then each province has a choice between cap or trade or carbon taxing or however they want to do it. They can, as long as they're included in the carbon taxing.
Yeah, that was a wonderful announcement. Mm-hmm. We're very excited to see that. We would like that to be improved upon. We would like to see that price extend past 2022, and we would like it to be stronger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also know some provinces already been implementing their own actions for the past few years. Like I know in Alberta last year, they began with $20 per ton rise and up to $30 by 2022. So I know that's another province. I guess some provinces have been doing it a little bit earlier.
Yeah, 80% of Canada's economy is under a carbon price. So we have British Columbia with a revenue neutral carbon tax started in 2008.
Yeah.
Quebec has been in a cap and trade deal with California that's really come into play in the last year. Clocking it and measuring it, the details are finally starting to come out. And Ontario is about to embark on a cap and trade deal with the California Quebec system. Couple things to note about that. There will be no official reporting from all the companies involved in that until 2021. Those are called true-ups, which is rather alarming. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And this is really critical to note. On September 1st, 2016, the state of California, the fifth largest economy in the world, passed a joint resolution asking the federal administration to pass a carbon fee and dividend like carbon pricing policy for the nation. Yeah, so that is fantastic. So, and as well, the cap and trade deal within the state of California expires in 2020. So there's no guarantees past 2020 that we're, yeah. So I think as we move forward, we need to look closely at what is happening. Those are just some things to keep in mind, that California doesn't, even their legislators don't want to do cap and trade. They would prefer a federal carbon fee and dividend system.
I feel like from what I've heard, because I know I've talked to other people in CCL, and they said cap and trade tends to be, any of them can work, but it's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, cap and trade is complicated. It also has exemptions. It can be susceptible to gaming or fiddling with. It's just not nearly as transparent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Brexit and the election of Donald Trump south of the border don't teach us a lesson, we're in trouble. The population is a little bit leery of the government, and if they create carbon pricing policies that nobody can understand or nobody can really see what the heck is happening.
It's definitely been a very eye-opening year.
Yeah. I think that's just a warning sign to the politicians. The more transparent carbon pricing policy should be considered given what's happened in Britain and the United States of America this year.
That's the end of part one of our interview with Kathy Orlando. In part two, Kathy will explain her recommended carbon pricing in more detail and she'll continue talking about her experiences as the National Manager of Citizens Climate Lobby Canada. So please stay tuned.